Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 1st, 2005. This session, Lutherans in and after the tsunami. Presented in the Fireside Room by Paul Harder. Disc number HAP-2005-02. Let's listen in.
Called Banda Aceh. Mm-hmm. And Banda... And Banda Aceh is a coastal town. Banda just means port an old version of Portuguese, Banda Aceh. And there is a Lutheran church located in Banda Aceh, and that's the story that I'm going to tell about how they, what they experienced on that Sunday morning. On December 26th.
And is that where you...
I visited there.
Yeah, but I mean, that's not where you were before.
No, that's right. Okay. I was in Dun John.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Aceh is, for many years, has had a separatist movement, something like the Tamil Tigers. Mm-hmm. And it's been closed to foreigners since about 1995. It used to have tourists that could go there. Aceh, and it is a beautiful country, part of the country. Banda Aceh and Aceh itself has historically always had more connection with Arabia than with the rest of the part of Indonesia, and that's one of the reasons that they never felt themselves a part of Indonesia. Banda Aceh is called the Serambi Mecca, which means the porch of, or the veranda of Mecca. Mm. It's 98% Muslim, and so it's a strongly Muslim area. The Lutherans, of the ethnic group called the Batak, have parishes all in Aceh, and their experience has been uniformly pretty good. They're not bothered by Islamic law and so on, and so this Lutheran parish is sort of the normal Lutheran parish in the city of Banda Aceh. Banda Aceh used to have something like 600,000 inhabitants in the city. And after that Sunday morning, they have maybe 400,000 to 450,000 people left. So on that morning, they lost, depending on where you get your statistics from, between 190,000 to 250,000 people dead in that one city or missing. And so the Lutheran parish there, which is simply called HKBP Banda Aceh, which is that's the acronym for the Batak Lutheran Church, HKBP, they had 600 baptized members, and after that Sunday morning, they had 500 baptized members. So they lost, 100 people out of 600 on that Sunday morning. And the video that I'm going to show was produced by the headquarters, the church headquarters of the Batak Lutheran Church. And it describes the first visit made by their church headquarters, or the church, the Batak Lutheran Church, to this devastated parish in the city of Banda Aceh, which lost so many people. Do you want to, would you... would you like to talk about your experience in India first?
A little bit, if you'd like.
Let's do that, and then we'll talk about that Sunday morning, December 26, 2004. Mm-hmm. I've already described the devastation that hit the people there. At 8:30 in the morning at this Lutheran church, they were preparing for worship, and there was the earthquake, a big earthquake. Mm-hmm. Many, many, many buildings were flattened.
Unrelated to the tsunami.
Well, the earthquake that produced the tsunami.
Aha.
You never felt the tsunami in India.
I mean, the earthquake.
The earthquake, yeah.
No.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I should introduce Hans and
Krista.
Yeah, Hans and Krista.
I'm Jim Nichols.
Hi, Jim.
Hello.
And Jim was in India precisely on December 26th. And the earthquake that produced the tsunami was felt very strongly in Banda Aceh. And perhaps tens of thousands of people were killed in the earthquake before the waves came. About an hour and a half to 2 hours later, or between 10 and 10:30 in the morning, the first of the two waves hit Banda Aceh. And the first wave was called the yellow wave, and the second wave was called the black wave. The waters came into the city low and very fast. I talked to someone who tried to outrun it in a motorcycle, and he said he was going 60 miles an hour, and he could not outrace the water that was coming so low and so fast. He was swept off his motorcycle, and he managed to get into a building that had a second floor. Mm-hmm. Up to 3 miles inland, the water reached 10 feet high. And the first yellow wave then was in place for about 10 to 15 minutes. And then it slowly went down. And then after that, the black wave came. They use these colors because the first wave didn't have as much debris. It was more pure water. And the second wave had all this debris. And one person described it to me as being like a soup made of barbed wire and wood and debris and bodies. If you were caught in it, people rarely survived. In a space of 30 to 40 minutes, all those people lost their lives in Banda Aceh. Now in India, how did the morning?
Excuse me, just a minute. People look through and then they leave. I wonder if they think this is just a little meeting. If you should open the door. Then
oh, sure.
Wonder.
Jim, were you in India?
No.
Maybe he misunderstood. Maybe he misspoke. I'm the one who was in India. Yeah. In India at the time of the tsunami.
Neither. I visited Banda Church way back in 1974. So. I'm enjoying being reminded of stories.
Are you a pastor?
Yeah. I was on the synod staff in Ohio at the time and represented our synod and subsequently shared the Batak story around the synod in Ohio way back in 1974.
Gotcha.
So it's, well, Batak.
It always goes in fits and starts, the Lutheran engagement with the Batak Church. When I was in Banda Aceh, I met four Missouri Synod missionaries who were seeking partners to be engaged with in Reconstruction. And Missouri Synod historically has not had a connection with the Batak Lutheran Church. But
they came to help.
They came to help.
That's a good sign.
You made reference Saturday, Paul, to the Batak's pride identification. One of my memorable experiences, I'll just throw in here. We were touring somewhere up there in Sumatra. We were out in a rice paddy. And our group stepped up onto, I don't know what it was, some sort of a platform cement kind of thing. It was out in the field, I don't know what it was. But our guide was telling us the Batak story as he understood it. And one of those tiny little Batak women walked up beside us. She had her dress tucked in her belt. Betel nut juice running down both sides of her mouth. And she looked at us, and when she got a chance, she said two words. I Batak. And it was like, you know, this picture and her standing in the rice paddy. Two words.
Moving.
Told the story.
And when was that?
That was 1974.
A few years ago.
Yes.
They have a very basic and intense connection with the earth, the land that they come from, and then their kinship groups. And it's a very special sort of a sense of ethnicity that far exceeds any sort of nationalism. They're Bataks before they're anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Even Lutherans, or whether they're Lutherans or Indonesians. It's,
is Batak a tribal name or a regional name, or both?
Well, the name is first mentioned by Marco Polo in the 13th century, called Batu. Batu. Marco Polo mentions, and He never met them, but he just mentions them as a name of a bloodthirsty cannibal group in the island to Sumatra. So that's the first Western mention of it.
So it's an ethnic group?
Yeah, yeah. 9 million members of the ethnic group. And there's sub-ethnic groups as well.
Well, Lutheran World Federation, I think, connects up with it. I think it's the only Lutheran church. This is what little I remember from church history or whatever, that is Lutheran without committing themselves to the Lutheran confessions.
They, in 1952, when they applied for membership in Luther World Federation, they, like many churches from the Evangelische tradition in Germany, didn't explicitly have the Augustana or the Lutheran confessions as their foundational document. So what they did was, this is very Batak, they wrote their own.
that's what they're thinking.
So they wrote their own confessions, and it's an Orthodox confession of faith. The first one, 54, which they wrote, is it has some quirks. It has a long list of anathemas, almost as long as the confession. but for that reason, that's one of the main reasons the Missouri Synod didn't become members of the Lutheran World Federation, because they allowed LWF allowed the HKBP, the HKBP, to become members of the LWF, even though they didn't explicitly have the Augustana or the Concordia as their confessional documents. And St. Louis objected to this and didn't pursue membership at that time. So it's an interesting connection between Missouri Synod. You being from Concordia, Portland, I assume you're from Missouri Synod?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I teach in Valpo, so we're sort of a mix of Missouri and the LCA there.
Do you know Fred Niemeyer pretty well?
Of course, he's a good friend.
You know Matt Becker now?
I do, yeah.
He's my protege.
Really? He's a great gift to the faculty.
Yeah. Our loss, your gain. Well, you give him my love. Two days before we left Portland, he called up, he wanted to talk to me, and I was out doing something, and my wife talked to him, so. Yeah, no, he was my protege. That's a long, simple story. Well, then you know that Portland is not your typical Missouri Synod Lutheran school.
Is there a typical? Well, I guess there is a typical Missouri Synod school. Well, since they're recording this, why don't we...
Yeah, we better... Are you recording this part of our conversation?
Of course, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh.
Why don't you tell your story?
Yeah, I bet.
December 26, 2004. Right.
Okay. All right, I'm Hans Bubbles, and I was asked to teach Old Testament, particularly Hebrew, at our Lutheran Seminary of the IELC, the India Evangelical Lutheran Church, in a city called Nagarkoil, which is at the very tip of India, and just 25 kilometers from the Kanyakumari, which is the tip of, and we are in a city of 250,000 people in a region that is largely Hindu, but a great percentage of Christians. Some people have estimated that 20% of the people are Christian. So it's quite amazing, because the percentage of Christians in India is 2.5%. Now, there may be more covert Christians, and we have the feeling that the gospel is spreading like a wildfire all over the place, but that's all just hearsay and anecdotal evidence. So the IELC was part of Missouri Synod's mission program and was a daughter church for a long time, a daughter mission, and then in about 1957 became an independent Lutheran church. But we're still connected with them. There are about 14 Lutheran churches in India, coming mainly from different areas, Danish, etc., 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 German, and so on. This is Missouri Synod people tend to be in the south section, or about maybe 200,000 Christians. I think I've got the number right. I may be wrong about that. But at any rate, the seminary had about 50 students who were preparing for the ministry mostly. And I was supposed to be there until December 9th, but because my work was not completed, I I was asked to stay longer, so I stayed until the end of my visa, which was March 1st. I left India on March 1st. That puts me into India at the time of the tsunami. I was on the steepest learning curve of my life. I'm in my fifth retirement now. And I've been teaching theology and Hebrew and all sorts of things at University of Portland. This coming year will be my 50th year. And now I've been here. And I say I was on the steepest learning curve because I was supposed to teach one course in Hebrew. Well, by the time I was finished, I was teaching four different courses. So I was up to my ears in teaching. And on 2 days, I arrived on a Friday, and I was told Sunday evening I was going to have to preach at an installation service. Well, I don't bring along a whole raft of sermons, and I'm basically not a preacher, I'm a teacher, although I have German service once a month. Mm-hmm. But I write, I'm a perfectionist and have to write every sermon out. And then on Wednesday, I had to preach at the opening service of the seminary, I was told. On Sunday, I had to preach at another church. On Monday evening, we had English Vespers. So when I say I was on the steepest learning curve of my life, it was that I was both like the representative of the president of the Missouri Synod, head of the mission board, the area director of the Missouri Synod Mission, Herb Hofer, plus being myself, I was preaching every Sunday at least twice, sometimes three times. Also speaking to various groups, Sunday school, women's, and Saturdays.
You had an early tsunami.
Listen, that's another part of the story. I had some very interesting personal encounters with people. That's another whole story. Those were really personal tsunamis. But yes, but I met a wonderful CSI, that's the Church of South India, Christian doctor, through a very interesting story which we don't have time for. But we became good friends in a short time, and he said, well, if you ever need to get away for a couple days, my beach house is available. I'm too busy doing what I'm doing, and so is my wife. So when I decided to stay through beyond December, mm-hmm. I said, here's my chance. And I was hoping for a week of vacation, mm-hmm. or not. Mm-hmm. His beach house was only about 120 yards from the water. It was facing directly to the water. And my dear Kurt Samuel and I were taken out there, and I was to be there a week. Well, Dr. Sromany, the man who ran my life, we invited him out for a little picnic, and part of his mid-plane solicitor and say part of what he brought along was, by the way, you are preaching Christmas Eve. And I said, Dr. Sromany, so well, they're expecting you. And we also have you scheduled for preaching Christmas Day, December 26th. I said, Dr. Sromany, I have not had one day off since I've been here, since September 20th. I need my R&R, I really do. And he said in all seriousness, he's a loving man, but he was serious. He said, look, at they are planning on you to come. They expect you to come. You
for December 25th.
December 25th and December 26th.
And the Sunday of the 26th.
Yes. And he said, you can get your R&R when you get back to the States. Mm-hmm. Well, people joke about me as not being able to say no. And this is one time in my life where it was a great blessing. Mm-hmm. Because we would have been there when a 10-meter wave hit that house unexpectedly at about 11:30 in the morning. Samuel would have been downstairs cooking. Mm-hmm. I would have been upstairs trying to grade papers. Mm-hmm. We went out the next morning. The house was standing. Dr. Ebenezer Solomon and I and his wife went out. But it was devastating. It was mm-hmm. devastated. And the whole place looked like a moon.
There was no forewarning of the tsunami.
So far as we knew, there was not. No, India had heard about it, but they felt it. The news got there, so it was not. It was not the tsunami warning system's fault, but they couldn't take it seriously. That's too far away; it would never harm us. So they made no news.
And was anybody in that house?
Well, there was supposed to be another person. Since I left, I had to leave prematurely. I had less than 48 hours before it hit. Mm-hmm. Another lady went out. She was going to stay for the weekend. But she was a teacher and felt she needed to get back to finish doing some work, so she left, I think, early Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. The thing hit at 11:30. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People around us, there were a number of people killed, Native people who lived right behind these nice houses. When we went the next morning, the house, both doors were totally smashed through by the water. There was no sign of the doors anymore. They were thick doors and they were bolted very heavily. All the few kitchen utensils they had and things they had in the little cupboard were washed out, the glass was washed out, mm-hmm. everything was gone.
Where was the house?
The house was 25 kilometers. We were 25 kilometers from Kanyakumari. That's the tip. And the house was about here, and also 25 kilometers from Nagercoil. Mm-hmm. The wave went in over a kilometer. We had to walk in, and there was devastation everywhere. It was like a moon landscape where we were. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, there was a line of palm trees that extended along between Dr. Ebenezer Solomon's property and the next property. All those palm trees stood, but everything else looked like a moon landscape.
And the water came in to a 1 kilometer inland.
Yes. Our house had water just up to 4 inches from the ceiling. And the ceiling was higher than this ceiling. Mm-hmm. So it was just filled with water. Mm-hmm. There were sand dunes this high in the middle of both rooms. Upstairs where I would have been staying, sand was washed in under the door. Mm-hmm. The house behind us, the lady who owned the house and her husband were there. No, just the lady was there. And she was furious because her husband didn't put in good foundations. The whole one corner of the house just collapsed. And down below, you saw these huge boulders. So he didn't put in the cement footings, but he put in boulders, and she was furious that he didn't. And she was a very articulate woman, a retired Christian principal of a women's school. The houses behind that were just wiped away. But when I compare the devastation that you, Paul, described, there's no comparison.
Well, it's well, you can think about the time frame of that morning, because it hit Banda Aceh between 10 and 10:30. And the tsunami in the morning, yeah.
Are we in the same time zone? Probably not.
No, definitely not.
So you were it hit you before it hit, it's got to have hit you before it hit us.
Right, definitely. Mm-hmm. And so how many hours did it take to travel in?
Well, that all depends on the time zones.
If it hit 10:30 in Banda Aceh, probably 9:30. It was 9:30 your time. So, yeah. So it took a longer time to get across the Indian Ocean.
I think so.
Yeah.
Now, Sumatra was very close to the quake, but Sri Lanka was devastated. Mm-hmm. And I could tell you stories that I heard. The most significant story we already shared informally is that there was a train going along the coast, mm-hmm. and they saw the first wave, what you call the yellow wave, and they saw, people saw it, and then it backed away, and they thought, well, there was some kind of wave, and the train kept going. Mm-hmm. Well, then came what you call the black wave, mm-hmm. and that just swept up. I think it was like a 40 meter wave is the way they described it. Just overwhelmed the train. Everyone was killed. The train was lost off the track. There was a Lutheran pastor and his wife were killed.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that his...
For some reason the second wave was the...
What made it larger than the first?
I have no clue. It just was that the first wave came in and then receded. And then the second wave came in. Mm-hmm. And it was deadlier, they say, because of the debris was heavier in the second wave.
But the water seemed to be higher.
Well, they all said the mass was much higher at the second wave.
Yeah, the second wave was
people
higher.
People climbed on the train hoping, they said they would be safe there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some people saw that first wave pull out and
they thought it was safe.
Some saw it pull out and they said, that means trouble. And they headed for higher ground in our area. But like Dr. Ebenezer Solomon went to Colachel, that was a fishing village. Most of the people who were killed were fishermen or fishermen families. Their houses were devastated. They were Catholic. Where I was on the beach, I walked every day I saw just a few kilometers down the road, there was a Catholic church. The Catholic church was on the seaward side of this, of the little McKenna road that went along the coast, on the seaward side. And they were, the population was in the church. The seaward wall came down. 40 people were instantly killed in the church, during the church. So of course, many questions were raised. But the place that was hit worst was Colachel, and doctors came in to some of his wife went there to see if they could help. But they said there was nothing they could do, so they turned around and went home. Because at that moment, they were just bringing bodies up onto the beach. And when they left, there were 200 bodies lined up. So for the people there, this was devastating and proportionate to the kind of devastation that you described in your book.
Well, let's talk about devastation now. I'll show you the short movie. You saw it already, Jim. So it's a short movie that was produced by the Bangtan Lutheran Church a week after the tsunami, where they begin, what they did was the Bangtan Lutheran Church sent a work team, two minivans filled with youth, to help clear out the Lutheran parish in Banda Aceh, our bodies, because I'll show you the pictures. The church, it's a traditional sort of Latin architecture. Well, no, it's not even Latin architecture. It's a long room with pews in it. And there's a pulpit in the center, which is in the old Evangelish tradition. There's a pulpit in the center, and they had also had the sacrament, the Lord's Supper, on Christmas, December 25th. And you'll see on the left side of the building, the wall is missing. And the water came into the church and deposited between 30 and 50 bodies. They didn't an exact count. And the mud and the debris left behind, the pictures which you'll see, and I'm supposed to warn you that it's graphic, but it's not that graphic, but the debris was about 3 feet high, mud and all this debris, and they were picking bodies out, and there's some footage of that. So this is footage from the Bangtan Lutheran Church about a week after the tsunami, and it speaks for itself. Let me turn it on.
As you move over there, Paul, I'm reminded after the more most recent. The earthquake off the coast of California, the registered on the Richter scale something close to the one that caused the tsunami. I was interested in hearing one of the differences was the difference of the so-called tectonic plates under the ocean, where, if I remember correctly, in the Indian Ocean, it was like they were vertical and one section dropped significantly.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Pacific, they're more horizontal, they move this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the lateral motion does not create the same sudden wave that came with the Indian Ocean.
It was the subduction zone, which is the seam, like you said.
Yes.
In the Pacific, it moves up and down. That's what you said. Yeah, that's right.
In the Pacific or the Indian?
In the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, Indian.
And it was up and down. Different.
Whereas on our coast, it slips under.
Yeah, it's because the plates from earlier
right.
movement of the continents are more layered laterally than they are vertically.
Mm. Okay, the first part of this movie, or this film, is the Secretary General of the Bangtan Lutheran Church. His name is Willem Sumarmata, a friend of mine, and he is on their way, they're on their way up to Banda Aceh, and it appears they just stopped by the side of the road and started filming this. So there's a lot of traffic noise. At that time, 100,000 people are dead. That's what he meant.
Yang di Banda Aceh dinyatakan hilang 100 members of the Lutheran Church Mandate are dead or missing. And 200 are refugees in North Sumatra. Dozens in the Lutheran hospital in Bolivia. He says, in a few moments we will witness the devastation in Sumatra.
Semua peralatan dalam gereja seperti altar, kunyung, meja, sound system, dan organ, dan juga
and you'll see the destroyed church, including the altar, the pulpit, the sound system.
Untuk meringankan beban yang telah mereka alami. Sekitar 110 rumah warga KBP juga di sana telah hancur dan sekarang
about 110 homes of church members are missing, are gone.
Agar semua kita dapat menguruskan mereka dapat menikmati kehidupan yang lebih baik lagi pada hari-hari yang akan datang seperti rencana kita untuk membangun kembali rumah ibadat, rumah pendeta, dan rumah-rumah.
Our plan is to rebuild the church, the parsonage, the deaconess house.
Kami sampaikan banyak terima kasih atas upaya teman-teman kita yang telah berangkat ke Aceh untuk melihat keadaan.
Let us pray together so that our nation will be healed.
This
is Gereja HKBP Banda Aceh.
It's a Sunday school building.
Terletak 3 km dari tepi laut.
And that's the church.
Gereja yang beranggotakan
140
keluarga ini akibat gempa bumi tsunami dengan kekuatan 8.9 skala Richter tanggal 6 Desember 2004.
That's the parsonage. The parsonage was not destroyed, well, damaged heavily. The guy is looking at what used to be the deaconess house.
Serta dua rumah pelayan, pekerja hilang lenyap tanpa bekas. Akibat hantaman gelombang air 200 km per jam ini merobohkan sayap kanan gedung gereja.
So the water came at 120 miles per hour.
Ruang konsistori.
That's the
point. Gedung sekolah ini, alat-alat inventaris hilang dan mobilernya pun lenyap. Semuanya rusak berat akibat gelombang air tsunami ini.
And then 30 bodies were swept into the chancel.
Melihat para relawan KKB Distrik 10 Medan Aceh mengevakuasi sekitar 39 mayat dari dalam gereja.
And they brought the pews out. Yeah. That's the parsonage again. All they had to do was clean it and replace all the doors. All the doors were blown out.
Our doors are doomed.
That's the sacristy that with the the roof that's missing. And they found a body there when I was there.
Really? And that's how many days later?
Almost 8 weeks.
Wow.
8 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
What is that fire? Are they burning the bodies?
What's that?
The fire.
Oh, I think they're just burning
debris.
Yeah.
The devastation.
Terlihat daerah Polili, sumber datangnya gelombang tsunami yang membunuh ribuan rumah-rumah rakyat dan ribuan.
This is the coast, the most heavily damaged, destroyed area. It's where 50,000 people all died and entire neighborhoods were erased.
Mm-hmm.
ours was selective, you know, and so you had survivors who lost parents, children, wives, cousins, uncles. So the whole survivor thing is, so here they're just totally wiped out.
That's the Bishop of Aceh and Medan, Midian Sarai.
Is Medan another village?
Medan is the capital city of the province of North Sumatra.
Okay.
He's the Bishop of Medan. And that's Nelson Surigar. He's the head of social services for the Batak Church. These two kids are orphans, but there weren't that many orphans, Lutheran orphans.
This is true.
And there it is.
Mm. Boy, it's a powerful picture. That'd be a total film.
And children are children.
I wish it were longer.
It's okay. It speaks volumes.
At this point yesterday, I showed some slides of my visit there.
Let's see.
Would you like to? We've got about 10 minutes left.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'll show you my experience of about 7 to 8 weeks after the event. This first one is of a shopping mall, because you begin your visit to Sumatra in Medan, which is a large modern city, and it's got everything, including Paris Hilton selling jeans, and outside transportation, private transportation is either luxury cars or these motorcycle taxis.
getting on the airport and getting into the airport to go to Aceh, there's this this group called Team Honda, who were sent by the Honda Motor Corporation, you know, motorcycles and cars, to go repair motorcycles. So they would go there and repair motorcycles for free.
Good.
You drive by, going into the city of Aceh, refugee camps everywhere. These are going to be medium-term housing for a long time for people. Lots of kids there, running around the streets, playing, smiling. Everyone's happy, which is strange.
Amazing, right.
And the airport is still full of transport planes. This one you don't often see in the U.S. It's a Russian-made military transport. And when I was there, there were still the refugee camps were consisted of these tents. But now I guess they're using more wooden medium-term housing.
Did that, was that a welcome sign when that walked in?
No, it said welcome.
There was no E on it. But...
Where?
Right there.
Oh, it does say welcome, it does. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, that's English welcome, but it's misspelled.
Yeah.
This is the airport, and to the left is a secondary military control tower from Turkey, because there was so much air traffic.
Is this Aceh or Bandar?
This is Aceh. This is having flown into Aceh. The slides got a little mixed up, the order. Now this is, if you remember from the movie, that's the parsonage behind the church. Mm-hmm. And by this time, you can compare it with the devastation from the film. The bulldozers, which are being paid for by ACT, Action of Churches Together, which is the ELCA's main multilateral relief agency. And many churches contribute to that, so PCUSA, Episcopalian, all that. Mm. And so that's where a lot of your money went if you contributed to ELCA relief funds. There's a guy on a bench there taking a nap. This is after lunch. And this is the Sunday school building, which they're cleaning up. There's still debris everywhere. It's a smashed sound system and a fan and some Christmas decorations. And the strangest thing to see in Aceh is these boats everywhere in the middle of town. This is still 3 to 4 miles inland. Mm-hmm. And there are these large fishing boats that have been swept inland. And some houses remain, but most are gone. This is even at least a mile and a half, 2 miles from the coast. Because if you look behind to the right side of that boat, you see those trees in the far background. That's the coast. And I would judge that to be at least a mile and a half, 2 miles.
Also hinter uns, und die Bäume sind dann an der Küste.
Did much of that debris swept off of there get dumped in a pile, as it were, somewhere inland?
Well, what they do is they take these front-end loaders and bulldozers and just bulldoze everything flat. Mm-hmm. So the debris is mainly from houses and dirt and things like that.
Well, I asked because it appears to be gone here, and I didn't know what happened to it.
Yeah, this is much closer to the sea. This is about a mile from the coast, judging from the trees in the back. And if we're to go back, I think by this time, yeah, you're right, there's much more debris because the waves had much more stuff to sweep up.
Well, with the force of them, it seemed like it just swept everything off its, the foundation.
Yeah. Well, at the coastline, it's a much cleaner sweep, and then all the debris got deposited further in.
And what's the primary building product? Is it masonry or wood?
They use cement and brick, brick and cement.
Yeah.
And they don't use a lot of reinforcing rods, and it all depends on the quality of the construction, because you see in the foreground, that's a foundation of a home. Mm-hmm. But on the left side, far, that's a building that did survive. The tents are from family members who survived and want to
make sure that the government knows that they still own that land. Mm. But as of last month, the government has ruled that there will be no rebuilding on the coast. Mm. Even up to here, it looks to be a mile and a half inland. There will be no rebuilding of neighborhoods. Mm. So if, for example, the owner of this building or someone from the family came back and wrote, "Pemilik rumah masih hidup," which means the owner of this home still lives. The owner of this home still lives.
Amazing.
In order to show that
possession. Right. Yeah.
And then 25404 Visca, it must be some sort of registration certificate in the land office. Mm. But it's completely beside the point, because the land office that held all the property records was swept away. Okay. So all property records are gone in the city of Banda Aceh. More devastation. This is right on the coast. Mm-hmm. So this particular building was covered by water. Mm. Because even at the coastline, even the second story building, the second story was covered with water. This is an electricity generating barge that was swept about 2 miles into the city.
Oh.
And that's a big boat. You can see from the guy's bike and motorcycle and people standing around.
It was swept into the city?
It was swept into the city.
It appears to be metal, is it?
What?
It's a metal structure?
It's a metal barge.
Yeah.
It's a metal barge that has...
Was it staffed? In other words, the crew was killed?
There were people. I mean, it's common, this is strange for us to see, but it's common in Indonesia to have electricity generating barges on the coast to give people electricity on the coast. And so this particular boat barge produced electricity for the city of Banda Aceh. Hmm. And it was torn from its moorings, and it was staffed. I didn't talk with anybody, any sailors, but it was manned. I mean, the boat was staffed, and it was swept into the middle of the city. Yeah. This is the city parade grounds where on 26th of December 2004 there was a municipal function. The mayor and all his staff were there giving awards. There was an award ceremony for the city. Well, the 80% of the city administration from mayor on down was lost, because this is the municipal sort of parade ground about a mile and a half from the coast. They were all swept away. This is a famous old structure in the city of Banda Aceh.
Excuse me, were they around the area where the plane was?
I don't know where exactly on this.
I mean, that's where the...
That's where the parade was, that's where the officials
people
were.
People must have been around there then.
Yeah, I don't know whether they were here or whether they were here.
No, but I mean in that area, right?
That's what he's saying.
Right, yeah. Right.
This is the parade carrier.
It's sort of the municipal parade ground. This is a famous old structure that tourists always go to take pictures of. It's the Baitur Rahman Mosque in Banda Aceh. It's about 400 years old, and it survived because most churches and mosques survived in Banda Aceh. Mosques survived because of the open architectural floor plan. The water has a place to go, whereas buildings that are just have a door basically exploded with the pressure of the water. Here, the water reached up to the level of the second story of this tower here, this minaret. Mm-hmm.
About 20 meters or 15 maybe?
That looks to be 25, 30 feet.
Feet, yeah, okay. Well,
and everywhere in town you see battered, rusting cars. In the in the refugee camps, they're plastered everywhere. These little signs that say "Dicari," which means being sought for or to look for. Mm-hmm. This girl is Azam Putra, is her name. Her nickname is Puput, if I can read it.
Yeah.
The other line is Nama Aya, name of the father, Badar Johan. At the time of the event, the victim, Puput, was in front of the Lamdingan Mosque.
Whoever has found her, please contact Asfan's cell phone number, 0813, blah, blah, blah. So that's sort of like after September 11th in New York. These things are plastered everywhere.
Yeah, gosh.
And in the refugee camps, there's pictures of lost children. Parents looking for lost children who put their picture up there. This is a UN camp, an EU, because the blue sign, the blue symbol up here is from the EU, the European Economic Community, the mm-hmm. European Community.
Yeah.
List of children, missing children.
What is the, well, that one sign there said children looking for parents. So what is the status of the
These children. This is pictures of children who survived, but whose parents didn't.
Yeah.
So there's both pictures of children who are missing, mm-hmm. that their parents put up, and pictures of children who are looking for their parents, because everybody was separated. So parents were still looking for their children, and they'd go into the refugee camp and look for pictures.
But what I'm asking is looking for parents, are these adoptable children that are searching for families system?
No.
Are they living in an orphanage or extended family?
I understand. Very quickly after the tsunami, the government of Indonesia made a public statement that there would be no international adoptions. Mm-hmm. So what this means is the children who are looking for lost parents, they're not looking for adoptive parents. They will be put in orphanages and be adopted, hopefully, but that's not what this is for. This is a Red Cross sign, children who are looking for their family. Again, this is children who survived, but they have no family members to contact. There you see the Team Honda gazebo, where you can go and get your motorcycle fixed. In this refugee camp. Life goes on, and one of the favorite drink there is a green coconut. Guy hacks off the top and puts a straw in it. These are kids,
kids
in the refugee camp. And I think we're out of time.